Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an education service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on deadly medicine right after this. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wish I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control. But you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into this power of our courts, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and free. That's right, it's free of charge. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school, is available on compact disc. That's not free. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. That's the place to start. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time, we were talking about a guy by the name of Albert Murphy and how he was selected for an important trial, a medical trial, and how those medical trials are set up so that they'll be ethical, effective, scientific, double-blind. It's the way we do business here in America. It's the way the FDA does business. It's the way the pharmaceutical companies do business, and it's the way our medical establishment, our doctors do business, like it or lump it. But in the book, why tens of thousands of heart patients died in America's worst drug disaster, it's just one of many. Vioxx is just the tip of the iceberg. Boys and girls, there's a lot of drugs out there. In fact, there are thousands of drugs out there, and every one of those drugs is a poison. And very few of those drugs have ever been tested for their long-term benefits or effects. A few have, but very few. And what that means is that everybody in America who takes those drugs is a long-term guinea pig. Now, if that's satisfactory to you, then get on with it. If it isn't satisfactory to you, then listen up. Because there's a significant difference between the use of drugs and the use of herbs. Now, one of the most carefully guarded secrets of the cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial was the ongoing results that occurred over the years. In order to protect this double-blind character of the trial, they were concealed from CAST Steering Committee Chairman Thomas Bigger, the Columbia University professor who had been a consultant for the 3M company, BioRinger Ingelheim, and Bristol Myers. The running totals were also not available to the vice chairman, Raymond L. Woolsey, the Vanderbilt University professor and FDA advisory committee member, who also had worked with most of the major drug companies. CAST had an independent data safety and monitoring board that met twice a year to assess the progress of the trial. But at its first meeting, the board decided to enter fully into the spirit of the double-blind trial, where neither the investigator nor the patient knows which is active medication and which is placebo. Now, while the board had the duty of monitoring the ongoing results, it had voted to blind itself to the identity of the placebo and the treatment groups. That decision was intended to render the board impartial. In making recommendations about the conduct of CAST, it would not know whether it was helping or hindering the proof of the arrhythmia suppression hypothesis. For example, the board learned the number of deaths in two blinded categories, simply labeled Group X and Group Y. Which group was getting the drug continued to remain a secret. For months after Albert Murphy was enrolled in CAST, these closely held numbers were totaled in preparation for a meeting of the safety board, without identifying which was active treatment and which was placebo. The results were, in group X, sudden death, 3, and in group Y, sudden deaths, 19. Total patients involved in these two groups was 576 in group X, of which 3 died, and 571 in group Y, of which 19 died. Until CAST reached its scheduled conclusion in 1992, the only reason for unblinding the data would be to consider calling an emergency halt to the trial. This could occur under two scenarios. The life-saving properties of the antiarrhythmic drug might prove so impressive that it would be unethical to allow the placebo patients to continue without the medication. Several National Institute of Health clinical trials had been halted on this logic. Or the drugs might prove to be so dangerous that it was unsafe to continue the trial. This is also had occurred in previous studies. Already the results were interesting. CAST had been designed under the hypothesis that antiarrhythmic drugs might reduce deaths by 30%. If group X was getting the drugs, they appeared to be reducing mortality by a phenomenal 80%. The numbers so far included only 5% of the deaths expected to occur over the 5-year course of the trial. If the trend continued, however, the disparity was large enough to raise the question of an emergency halt. While the safety data and monitoring board could express an opinion, it was a purely advisory body, and under the CAST protocol, a premature halt to the trial was a matter of the and for the project officer. His name was Lawrence M. Friedman. Now, Friedman was the son of two New York City public school teachers. He had been among the flood of bright young doctors who met their military obligation during the Vietnam War with a research fellowship at the National Institute of Health. After finishing his residency at Hartford Hospital in Connecticut in 1972, he was assigned to the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Friedman went immediately to work on the first randomized clinical trial that the Heart Institute had ever sponsored, the Coronary Drug Project. With hundreds or even thousands of participants, a randomized clinical trial required a coordinated national effort, often lasting a decade or more, and it meant getting scores of fiercely independent doctors to work together as a team. Dozens of hospitals were involved in each project. Each had its own paperwork, its own funding procedures, and independent review boards. Thus, the clinical trial was a new kind of research that produced a new kind of knowledge and required managers with an unusual combination of skills. It required patience and a team player, someone with medical knowledge, mathematical aptitude, and managerial ability. Helping to manage such a large clinical trial was a brand new job in medicine, and it fully suited Lawrence Friedman so perfectly that he never did anything else. He liked the complex questions that involved both advanced mathematics and medicine. He proved able to manage multi-million dollar research budgets. Most of all, the quiet and soft-spoken Friedman turned out to be a skillful consensus manager. And at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, the buck rarely stops anywhere. It is referred to another committee. Thus, it was under Friedman's patient husbandry and through an endless sequence of committees that CAST was first conceived, developed into a complete plan, and came to have an independent life of its own. When he was asked, Friedman did not remember who first suggested CAST, nor could he name any individual who had forcefully promoted it. It evolved from a workshop on sudden death held back in the late 1970s. It was endorsed by the Advisory Committee for the Division of Epidemiology and Clinical Applications where Friedman worked. The proposal went up to the director's office, who referred it to his advisory council of prominent doctors. That led to a 3-year pilot study, which was designed by another committee with several subcommittees. There was only one serious controversy that rippled through this smooth flow of committee work, and that involved drug selection. Although Friedman was project officer, he did not choose which drugs would be tested. That was a question for the drug selection committee. That was chaired by Raymond Woosley of Vanderbilt University. One major faction wanted to include one of the drugs that most doctors used and trusted. It was quinidine, or procainamide. This would make the results of the trial immediately applicable to existing clinical practice. Others advocated specific drugs. Bigger, who chaired the steering committee, wanted an antidepressant drug whose antiarrhythmic properties had been tested in his own laboratory, imipramine. Craig Pratt of Baylor University favored ethmazine, the drug that Bernard Laun had brought back from the Soviet Union and Joel Morgenroth had initially tested years before. Pratt was then working with DuPont on ethmazine, on which development had resumed after a long hiatus. Numerous committee members had experienced with Tambacor and Encade. In the end, the committee chose the new drugs that committee members had been recently testing rather than the established drugs that most doctors already knew. Bigger got imipramine. Pratt won approval for ethmazine. Tambacor and Enkade were easy consensus choices. Before the main trial began, a pilot study was conducted to demonstrate that the four drugs selected could safely and effectively suppress premature beats under the demanding conditions of a randomized clinical trial. Like almost all clinical trials, the pilot study provided a few surprises. Bigger's drug, imipramine, proved something like a fiasco. It had the lowest rate of effectiveness, only 59%, and the highest rate of intolerable side effects, 18%. Ethmazine was notably less effective than Enkade and Tambacor, but was well tolerated by most patients and remained a second choice drug. In the pilot study, as in early clinical testing, Tambacor and Enkade proved remarkably effective in suppressing PVCs and were well tolerated by patients. Joel Morgenroth had joined the study as a principal investigator for the site in Philadelphia. So enthusiastic was Morgenroth during this period that he wrote an editorial in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, and it was entitled, "Have We Reached Antiarrhythmic Nirvana?" When the Data Safety and Monitoring Board gathered in Washington, D.C. in September of 1988, it learned of the difference in deaths occurring in Group X and Group Y. The board was chaired by a cardiologist named J. David Bristow from the Oregon Health Sciences University and included members from the Harvard, Duke, Georgetown, the universities of Wisconsin and Colorado. Tom Bigger, as chairman of the overall trial, attended unless results were being discussed. Although it was only the second meeting of the board, the same group had monitored the pilot study, and they had worked together for years as project officer, and Friedman attended ex officio. The most important task before the board that September was to set guidelines for halting the trial for safety reasons. Was 3 versus 19 sudden deaths an expected eddy in the river of data, or did it signal a flow of events already veering on an entirely unexpected course? That was in part a mathematical question. And outlined their choices, the committee had available to them the CAST biostatistician, Alfred Holstrom, of the University of Washington in Seattle. He also managed the CAST Coordinating Center, and he was responsible for the security, the accuracy, and the integrity of the data. Holstrom was a numbers doctor, not a medical doctor. He had a PhD in mathematics from Brown University. And he knew that before the safety board could define the conditions for halting the trial prematurely, that it first had to agree on a definition of success. So while the CAST investigators had already articulated a clear hypothesis, suppressing premature beats prevents sudden death, they were still lacking a specific definition of its proof. Such definitions are accepted as convincing only when they are specified far in advance of the results. They are normally calculated in terms of probability that the results achieved were just a nasty trick played by the freak of chance. Now, the strictest customary standard allows only one chance in 100 that the results were a statistical fluke. The most lenient typically allows 5 chances, or a probability of 0.05. Like any standard, the more lenient the test, the easier it is to pass. Now, the CAST chairman, Thomas Bigger, representing the 198 doctors who were CAST investigators, proposed the more lenient 0.05 standard. Then he recommended an additional specification to make it more lenient still. The investigators wanted to declare that the trial only sought to ascertain benefit. That meant Bigger believed the possibility of harm was so remote that it was not necessary to plan to detect it. In traffic engineering, this is the equivalent of purchasing half of the normal number of traffic signs for a stretch of highway because you're already convinced in advance that the cars will only move in one direction. This was Thomas Bigger's proposal. Now, that was the proposed definition of proof. The question of when to stop the trial early still remained open, and the board had tentatively accepted a plan that also precluded the possibility of harm. The approach was called stochastic curtailment, and it was another game of chance. The trial would halt when the chances of proving benefit were too remote. Given the results at any particular point, Holstrom could calculate the chances of proving the anticipated benefit. It was like a baseball game that allowed the home team to call off the game if it fell hopelessly behind. Now, while the CAST investigators were playing an honest game, and a very difficult game, they did write the rules in their own favor. They were willing to settle for the smallest apparent benefit meeting commonly accepted scientific standards. And they wanted a structure that eliminated the possibility of ever proving that the drugs were harmful, even by accident. If the drugs were in fact harmful, convincing proof of this could not occur because the trial would be halted when the chances of proving benefit had become too remote. That was what Bigger and the CAST investigators wanted. However, the safety board did not agree. What happened next was a kind of statistical sleight of hand. The board allowed the investigators to assume the trial was conducted only to prove benefit. But it insisted on a higher standard of proof. Instead of allowing 5 chances in 100 of a fluke result, it insisted on results definitive enough to allow only 2.5 chances. In the traffic analogy, the board would allow the investigators to order only enough traffic signs for one-way traffic. But they reduced the stretch of highway involved by 50%. If perchance the traffic did flow both ways, there would still be enough traffic signs for that stretch of highway. In the silken politics of medical consensus, the safety board had said no to the investigators so smoothly they could hardly tell what had happened. So by an equally subtle maneuver, the safety board also established a specific advisory boundary for harm. Since the board had voted to remain ignorant of the identities of the treatment and placebo groups, both treatment and harm would, of necessity, be tested against the same boundary. So the safety board membership included David Demetz of the University of Wisconsin. He was a world-class statistician who had helped devise the formulas used to establish the advisory boundaries. Just as they adopted them at the September 1988 meeting, Demetz noted that with 3 versus 19 sudden deaths, they must already be very close to the boundary. Those in group Y were 6 times more likely to experience a cardiac arrest than those in group X. The effect of these 3 antiarrhythmic drugs were already striking. Now, Lawrence Friedman, the project officer, asked, well, does it matter which way the trend is going? He wanted to know if the safety board would stop the trial now if they knew treatment was beneficial, or would knowing treatment might be harmful result in a different decision. The group decided unanimously that either way they wanted to continue the trial. The differences were large, but the absolute number of deaths was very small. Meanwhile, the death watch continued. On Thursday night of each week, the central computer at the Seattle Coordinating Center would automatically telephone the personal computers at each of the 27 sites and retrieve all of the data collected and entered during the week. On Friday, Hallstrom's programming staff would verify the test and test the data for accuracy and then update the center's master file of the results. The following Monday, a new value for deaths in Group X and Group Y would be calculated. On Monday or Tuesday of each week, Hallstrom would get the results. It was just a 3-line report that showed deaths in Group X and deaths in Group Y and the likelihood that the result had occurred by chance. Hallstrom said that he never looked particularly for the report and couldn't remember which day of the week it came. But with each passing week, the number of deaths in Group X and in Group Y slowly increased. Among the CAS leadership, only Hallstrom knew which group was taking the active drug. He bore his secret knowledge comfortably. He was a plain-spoken mathematician and not prone to dramatic flourish. For more than a decade, he had been the biostatistician for Medic One, the pioneering emergency ambulance service in Seattle. And although he had helped collect and interpret the data about the dramatic resuscitation of cardiac arrest victims, he had never once gone out on an ambulance to actually observe what happened. It wouldn't have been productive, he said later. Well, in late October of 1988, Albert Murphy returned to Washington Hospital Center for his first follow-up visit. The visit had several purposes. So he sat down for an interview with Diane Law, the nurse who had recruited him into the study. And she went down a list of adverse effects. Did he ever feel dizzy, nauseated, and so forth? Murphy had no adverse effects, and Law also took his EKG, where she saw abnormal Q waves. It's the telltale electrical evidence of a prior heart attack. He also filled out a questionnaire about the overall quality of his life. The CAST investigators hoped that even if the medication did not prevent sudden death, they might still emerge with evidence that antiarrhythmic drugs improved the patient's quality of life on a day-to-day basis. Murphy had also brought in his medication bottles, which had originally contained a 4-month supply. Diane Law shook out the few pills remaining and made a count. He had taken 400 pills during a period in which he should have taken 405 pills. This was 99% compliance, superior to the CAST average, which was about 80%. For a drug taken for a condition with few overt symptoms, even 80% is an excellent compliance rate. For the CAST investigators to demonstrate that the lives saved resulted from the medication, they needed proof that the patients, in fact, did take the drugs. And this was not always the case. In the Heart Institute's trial of the cholesterol-lowering drug Quistran, it proved such an unpleasant drug that 1/3 of the doses were never taken. As a result, minimal cholesterol-lowering and disappointing results had been achieved. Diane Law had another reason for checking Albert Murphy's medication. From the nearby empty bottle, she took one of his pills. She wrapped it in cotton, sealed it in a plastic bag, and attached a sticker with Murphy's ID number, 008927-3AMUR. And during the month of October 1988, the same procedure was followed for every patient who came in for a follow-up visit. So that by month's end, Washington Hospital Center had 32 plastic bags with sample tablets. And this was repeated at all of the 27 CAS sites. All of the envelopes, almost 400 from the whole study, were sent to the Seattle Coordinating Center. When all of the envelopes were collected, they were given to Serena Qatar, an Iranian-born data technician who worked at the center and was known for his meticulous work. He took all of the pills into a room along with a register of patent ID numbers. Then, one by one, he broke the pills in half. While identical from the outside, the placebos and the active drugs had different color fillings. This was a closely guarded caste secret. The staff was greatly concerned when a cooperating physician called to say that he had taken it upon himself to reduce the dose for an elderly patient by one half tablet. They worried that if he did this again, he might happen to observe the different colored fillings, and the double-blind character of the trial would be broken. When Serena Qatar finished with the pills, his results were checked against the master register. There were no mistakes, and in a trial that was already tending toward a definitive result, it was essential to be confident that those believed to be taking the active drug were actually doing so. With thousands of coated bottles scattered around the world, a medication foul-up was indeed possible. As in any careful counting exercise, unforeseen events invariably arose, and the center staff had to decide on the gender of a participant with a sex change operation. A male, they decided. Another had a heart transplant. He was censored or removed from the study on the date that he had a new heart. One patient suffered a cardiac arrest before taking a single dose of the study medication, and although he had been previously taking the active drug to establish its effectiveness, the patient was resuscitated. Because technically he had entered the treatment group, the cardiac arrest was counted in the official results. Just 2 weeks after the September meeting, where the Data Safety and Monitoring Board set advisory boundaries for halting CAST, the steering committee gathered in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Everybody who worked on CAST was a member of the steering committee and was invited to the twice-yearly meetings near one of the study sites. It was a fringe benefit, especially for the 84 research nurses who worked full-time on CAST. Other meetings would be held at Banff, the scenic park in the Canadian Rockies near the Alberta site, and at Newport, Rhode Island. The participants heard of progress and progress reports, and in the intervening weeks, the number of participants and deaths had continued to increase. The steering committee, however, heard only the gross totals. 1,563 patients recruited, 91 had died, or 6%. There was not the slightest hint about the large difference between Group X and Group Y. 41 of these deaths had occurred during the two-week period while the effectiveness of the drug was being established, and therefore they did not count toward proving or disproving the arrhythmia suppression hypothesis. The investigators also reported that doctors responding to the drug marketing barrage were increasingly insistent that their patients get anti-arrhythmic drugs and refused to allow patients to participate in the trial. Morris and Hodges of the University of Minnesota told the committee that private physicians increasingly feared malpractice lawsuits if they didn't use anti-arrhythmic drugs in their patients. Meanwhile, week after week, Al Hallstrom got the printout with the totals for Group X and Group Y. In absolute size, the numbers got steadily larger as the total deaths mounted. However, the gap between the two groups did not diminish. There was no random change in direction. By January of 1989, 3 months remained before the safety board's next scheduled official review of the data. Hallstrom decided that he could not wait. Well, let's take a minute here and let me remind you that this is a review of a book called Deadly Medicine, Why Tens of Thousands of Heart Patients Died in America's Worst Drug Disaster. It's written by Thomas J. Moore. Published by Simon & Schuster, published in 1995. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 1-417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. In January of 1989, the CAST project officer, Lawrence Friedman, was attending a workshop on cost-benefit analysis in clinical trials for a doctor who spent his career managing experiments that cost $10 million to $150 million each. The subject was a natural. These techniques might show that clinical trials could bring savings in medical care spending that far exceeded their substantial cost. The workshop was being held on the National Institute of Health campus in Bethesda, Maryland. During a break, Friedman ran into Al Hulstrom, who had come from the Seattle Cast Coordinating Center to attend the same meeting. Quietly, Hulstrom took Friedman aside. He said, "We've got some problems." Until then, Friedman had been, like the other board members, blinded to whether the emerging trend signaled accumulating benefit or increasing harm. But now Hulstrom revealed to Friedman that the results showed that the antiarrhythmic drugs were killing patients. And he told Friedman that the trend toward excess deaths among patients on the active drug had not reversed as they had expected. "We weren't seeing what you would expect," he said. "If the sicker people had died off in one group, they still should be available to die on the other group, and it ought to start to switch. This has not happened yet." So Hulstrom showed Friedman the totals broken down by drug and asked, "Should we be concerned?" Friedman wanted to take a closer look. So as the two men sat down together, Friedman came up with 30 different ways to analyze the data for clues about what might be going on. Neither man wanted to halt a $40 million experiment in which both had invested years of their lives only to discover that they had overlooked some obvious factor. The numbers already told one story. The results for two drugs, Tambacor and Encade, were notably different than for the third, Ethmazine. The trend toward harm was confined to Tambacor and Encade. The significance of even this obvious difference was difficult to determine because Ethmazine was a second-choice drug and taken by far fewer patients. It was used if Tambacor and Encade failed to suppress premature beats and in patients with heart failure, where it was feared the other two drugs might further depress already inadequate cardiac output. Therefore, Ethmazine was being given to a different patient population, if anything, a slightly sicker population at greater risk of dying. So while the Ethmazine numbers were small, they pointed towards some benefit. Hulstrom thought the bottom line death totals had another peculiar feature. The placebo group had fewer deaths than expected among typical survivors of a recent heart attack. In other studies, including the pilot for CAST, the first-year mortality was approximately 10%. Only 4% of the placebo group had died over about 9 months on placebo, so this made Hulstrom suspicious. The random assignment of patients to a control and treatment group is intended to create two patient populations that are similar. Through some fluke, could a disproportionate number of healthier patients have ended up in the placebo group? So Friedman and Hulstrom discussed two ways to answer that question. The CAST central computer files contained an immense collection of medical data about all of the participants. By combing through the data, they might uncover any significant differences between the two patient groups. Hulstrom had another idea he thought might save the trial. Under the guise of needing to check out medication that had mysteriously degraded, they could recall all of the bottles and secretly switch the Tambacor and the Encade patients to a placebo. The patients would be taken off of a potentially harmful medication, and also, with both groups on placebo, it would be possible to observe whether a difference in death rates continued or the results became similar. Friedman was uncertain about the second plan. So Hulstrom returned to Seattle to analyze the data at length, looking for some other factor that might explain the difference in the deaths occurring in these two groups. Now, until this analysis was complete, the two men decided not to share the troubling results with anyone else in the chain of command of CAST or at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. However, unless Hulstrom turned up some complicating factor, the results for Tambacor and Encade seemed to be definitive. When given to heart attack survivors, more than twice as many died on the active drug compared with the placebo. The most dramatic differences occurred in the very event the drug was intended to prevent, sudden death or cardiac arrest. Now, compared with a placebo, those on the active drug were three times more likely to have their heart abruptly stop beating, and dozens of additional deaths had occurred while an effective dose was being established before the trial death count officially commenced. It had taken 14 years after Tambacor was given to the first patients in testing to make this discovery. So for 14 years, Tambacor had been on the market, or out in the marketplace, being sold to millions of people. Hulstrom and Friedman were still not certain the finding was valid. So Hulstrom analyzed the Tambacor and Encade data exhaustively. He had 60 different measures with which he could compare those on placebo, 755 patients. With those on an active drug, 772 patients. Such was the power of randomization that the similarity between groups was nothing less than remarkable. So here are some of the examples. They looked at smokers, people with no chest pains, people with bypass surgery or previous cardiac arrest, male sex, female sex, people who took four other drugs, and ejection factor, and the average age of the participants and the initial PVCs per hour. All of this was reviewed in placebo group and the treatment group. So perhaps the most sensitive single indicator was a measure of damage to the heart and ejection factor. With each contraction, a normal heart ejects at least 55% of the blood in the main pumping chamber. That's called the left ventricle. If enough heart muscle cells are destroyed in heart attack, the ejection factor falls. It's also a major predictor of survival. So when Holmstrom compared the two groups, they contained roughly equal numbers of the high-risk patients, those with an ejection factor below 30%. When analyzed as separate groups, the adverse effects of the drug were compelling among both those with more and less severely damaged hearts. An unexpectedly healthy placebo group did not explain the difference in these test results. So as Holmstrom examined the records of those who died and those who survived, no telltale patterns emerged to suggest some other unique factor to explain these deaths. So he looked at the dosage. He looked for signs of interaction with other medications. And he wondered whether it was safer to wait until several months after the heart attack to start the drug. He could define a subgroup of patients at high risk, for example, those beginning to experience heart failure from dangerously low cardiac output. He could focus on seemingly low-risk patients, those without chest pains, those with low cholesterol, and those without high blood pressure. The death rates varied among these, and depending on their underlying health status, but in each analysis, the death rate was higher among those taking the active drug compared with the placebos. So in mid-February, Holmstrom and Friedman discussed by telephone the compelling results of Holmstrom's analysis. By now, both men knew that there was no escaping the conclusion that the CAST study was providing hundreds of patients with medication that might kill them. And they also realized they could keep the facts to themselves no longer. Friedman notified his boss, William Harlan. Harlan was the director of the Division of Epidemiology and Clinical Applications. Harlan quickly passed on word to Claude Lenfant, director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Lenfant didn't tell them what to do, but he emphasized that the situation required decisive action. And what he didn't want was an endless debate. Friedman and Holmstrom also telephoned J. David Bristow. He was the chairman of the CAST Data Safety and Monitoring Board. They informed him of the results, and Holmstrom dispatched a packet of charts and tables displaying the results of his data analysis. Bristow decided the material should be shared with the entire board without waiting for the regular April meeting. A conference call was set for March 2nd. Now, Holmstrom prepared a package for each member of the Data Safety and Monitoring Board. The first element was 50 pages of charts and tables. In accord with the board's policy to remain blinded, the treatment and placebo groups were not identified. The results were labeled Group X and Group Y. When they were arrayed graphically to plot deaths over time, one trend was immediately visible. Bigger, Woosley, and the other doctors who had helped develop Tambacor and Encade assumed that any adverse effects of the drug would appear within the first 2 weeks of starting the drug. So as the lines plotting survival stretched across Holmstrom's chart, the opposite conclusion was immediately apparent. The longer the trial continued, the greater contrast they observed in the deaths between these two groups. Now, in a separate sealed envelope marked Do Not Open, Holmstrom had enclosed the codes identifying X as placebo and Y as treatment. The sealed packet also included the results of specific drugs. In a cover letter, Holmstrom warned the board members not to leave the materials lying around, but he remained non-committal about the results. It appeared that there is a reasonable likelihood that we may cross one of the boundaries discussed at the last meeting, and by the time of our next meeting, Holmstrom told them, the reason for providing the material early, he explained, was the high likelihood that the board would recommend changes in CAST at its April meeting. But without opening the sealed envelope, the recipient could not know whether CAST had produced a larger than anticipated benefit or a major hazard to life. 15 persons joined in the conference call. 7 members of the Data Safety and Monitoring Board were joined by Friedman and by 3 associates of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute who helped him coordinate CAST. Holmstrom participated along with his 3 most senior colleagues at the Seattle Coordinating Center. Despite the sealed envelopes, there was little suspense about the results, and by the time that Bristow, the chairman, started the meeting, everyone knew the data indicated harm. As the discussion proceeded, Few doubted the results were valid. However, the harmful effects appeared to be restricted to Tambacor and Encate. If one included in the overall totals the seemingly more favorable results for ethomazine, the trial was still inconclusive in formal statistical terms. Officially, they were not testing individual drugs, but rather the effect of suppressing premature beats. Therefore, one choice was to halt the trial, announcing only that the treatment was unlikely to prove beneficial. One participant said that this would actually be a loss for the drug therapy. They would have failed to prove the expected benefit. Now, another participant, perhaps more sensitive to the power of drug company marketing, thought the opposite would occur, that unless the drugs were proven harmful, many physicians would still prescribe these drugs. This had happened when the negative but inconclusive results for Mexitil in the IMPACT trial seemed to have generated more questions about the trial than about the safety of the drug. So the board had to grapple with these conflicting moral obligations. If the members focused on their responsibility to the study participants, they ought to stop the trial, stop the program as soon as possible. The only serious future prospect was of observing increased harm. However, to meet the needs of greater society and protect the safety of the hundreds of thousands of patients now taking these drugs, a definitive result was now essential. A second thread also ran through the conversation. The safety board had worked together since the beginning of the pilot study in 1983. So why did Tambacor and Encade look so safe in the pilot study and so lethal in the CAST study? Nobody had an answer. The safety board also had to address a sensitive question of medical politics. They had excluded one key figure from the meeting, J. Thomas Bigger, Jr., chairman of the steering committee and a prominent proponent of the suppression hypothesis. Bigger would normally attend their April meeting in a few weeks. Bigger was also a principal investigator for the Columbia University site in New York City. Knowing the results would breach the double-blinded design and place him in a difficult ethical position as a physician responsible for dozens of patients, the board decided to tell him nothing of the results. They agreed to start the April meeting one day early on a Sunday afternoon in Seattle without informing Bigger. By the time he arrived as scheduled on Monday, they expected to have reached a firm recommendation on the fate of the cardiac arrhythmia suppression trial. To prepare for the April meeting, Hallstrom did some further double-checking. The board wanted the Seattle Coordinating Center to verify the assignment to treatment and placebo for the entire CAST population. Hallstrom also ordered a procedure called a vital status sweep. Sometimes the CAST staff at a hospital site would not learn of a patient death until they attempted to schedule the next four-month follow-up visit, and then they discovered that the participant had died. Current status was determined through a telephone check of all of the patients. Because conclusions of great importance were going to be drawn from relatively small numbers, even a small difference would have great impact. So the Data Safety and Monitoring Board met in Al Hallstrom's office on Sunday, April the 17th. The coordinating center occupied half of the third floor of an office building on 45th Street Northwest, a main thoroughfare that leads past the gates of the nearby University of Washington campus. It was a utilitarian office. Four work tables were pulled together to form a large conference table, surrounded by plain wooden chairs. In Seattle, a city of splendid views of the water, a row of windows overlooked only passing traffic on 45th Street. J. David Bristow, the chairman, presided. Lawrence Friedman was joined by William Harlan, his boss at the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. In a summary similar to the closing arguments of a courtroom trial, Al Hallstrom reviewed the rules that the board had adopted to monitor the CAST and outlined the latest results. When the treatment group was compared with the placebo group, the evidence convincingly showed the drugs were harmful. Members of the treatment group were twice as likely to experience cardiac arrest or sudden death as those in the placebo group. The chances were much less than 1 in 100 that these results could have occurred by chance. An additional patient deaths occurred while establishing that the drugs suppressed premature beats, and these deaths were not counted in the results. The board had established an advisory boundary for harm at 0.025 or 2.5 chances in 100 that the results occurred by chance. Current results showed the probability of a statistical fluke was from 1 to 2 in 1,000. Hallstrom had conducted statistical studies to see if other differences between patients could explain the excess deaths in the treatment group, and they did not. The board completed its discussion Sunday night, postponing a decision until the next morning. Bristow outlined three options. They could continue the trial, seeking a more definitive result. Bristow said he detected no support for this position. They could stop the trial altogether, but Bristow noted they would have unanswered the question whether ethmazine was beneficial. In light of the promising but inconclusive results with ethmazine, they also would not have settled the arrhythmia suppression hypothesis. Finally, Bristow said they could continue the trial with ethmazine, but extend the protocol to include deaths occurring during the first 2 weeks testing for effective suppression. The chairman, it was clear, wanted to continue the trial with ethmazine, but the board appeared satisfied with the evidence that Tambacor and Encaid were harmful to these patients. For the Monday session, the board had summoned three men, Thomas Bigger, the CAS steering committee chairman, Raymond Woosley, vice chairman, and the third committee member, George Weiss, a cardiologist from Alberta, Canada. As the three doctors filed into the session in Al Hallstrom's office, none of them knew anything about the results. Thomas Bigger and Woosley had spent years helping to develop and promote antiarrhythmic drugs. Woosley had helped to persuade Bristol-Myers that Encaid was a viable drug. He encouraged 3M to bring Tambacor to market. Well, when he heard Thomas Bigger turned ashen white, to some observers, Raymond Woosley looked almost relieved to know the answer. But as Woosley remembered it, he was simply shocked. The third senior investigator summoned for the meeting, Weiss, was mainly worried about his patients. And although it happens every day in modern medicine, the moment a doctor realizes that he has harmed a patient is still a terrible sensation. However, the superstars of medicine do not become paralyzed and wring their hands even when faced with a disaster. They were soon back at work with the committee, briskly planning what was going to happen next. There was plenty of work to be done. CAST needed a new protocol. They had to figure out how to communicate the results to the other 312 doctors, nurses, and other researchers who had worked on the trial. Hundreds of CAST patients had been taken off of Tambacor and Encaid immediately. The meeting was over by 9:45 a.m., and as the group filed out, and Al Hallstrom of his office in Seattle, it was not immediately clear how many of them understood the magnitude of the events that were going to unfold next. The world at large was going to learn that hundreds of thousands of people were taking drugs that might cause them to drop dead at any moment with absolutely no warning. Someone, presumably, was going to ask how such drugs could ever have been approved and prescribed for so many people. Now, we're talking about deadly medicine, why tens of thousands of heart patients died in America's worst drug disaster, written by Thomas J. Moore, published by Simon & Schuster, 1995. Now, that's when it was published. That's not the price of the book. It was first published in 1995 after these results became known. Well, I'm about out of time, and I have to leave it right there. We'll take it up right here next time, talking about deadly medicine. You've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's my signal, boys and girls. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.